I guess we'll kick off here. Microsoft told me I had to show you all this stuff, so there's that stuff. Everyone good with that? All right. So hello. You guys saw this earlier, so I'm Grant Skinner. You know, feel free to tweet me. Specifically to address some of the challenges that we were starting to face in HTML5. You know, building really rich content, stuff like games, visualizations, that kind of thing. Sort of what traditionally we'd been building in the Flash world, and we wanted to be able to build the same kind of stuff using web standards. And we didn't really find a lot out there that made it easy. And so as we started working on things like Pirates Love Daisies, we started to build libraries that initially we could use internally or reuse internally. And then we thought, you know, why don't we open source this stuff and make it easy for other people to build this type of content? So what's it good for? Bunch of stuff. Let's just go through all of these. So it's not for building websites. Wouldn't be something I recommend. Not for building applications. But it is good for stuff other than just games. We're seeing people do some really cool stuff in the data visualization space, doing experimental work, integrated animations, so like animations that live in a whole page, not that are necessarily the whole page on their own. Actually really good for things like banner ads. We're working with some of the groups that create standards around banner ads, and they're really excited about what we're doing with this because we can create really tight, small, interactive pieces. And you know, stuff like infographics, you know, critical things like spinning, flaming logos. I mean, we all need those again, right? Lots of different stuff. Some examples of this, I showed Atari Arcade earlier today, so maybe we won't get into this right now. If we want, we can come back and take a look at Atari Arcade in a little bit more depth. I'll show you a bit about how these libraries work, and maybe we'll come back to Atari Arcade and I can explain sort of how some of these concepts fit into the actual project. While I said that it's not necessarily great for building a whole site, you can actually build some pretty cool integrated experiences that leverage CreateJS in a really core way. So this is Dom Perignon's current site. I'm over 18, let me in. And this is multi-award winning. And this uses a really nice hybrid of CreateJS to do a bunch of the animation and some of the interaction, and it pairs it with HTML that's been intelligently layered over top for content. So, you know, really nice, rich site. And, you know, again, kind of looking like the type of stuff that we saw built using Flash, but now possible to do entirely on open web standards. And this is another example. There's a company called Periscope. They've been doing a lot of data visualization stuff with CreateJS. I'll talk a little more about the stuff they've been doing, but this is a little explorer for the different charitable grants that HP has done over the last few years. And, you know, pretty straightforward, but it basically leverages CreateJS for what it's great at, you know, drawing out this grid, and then it uses HTML for a lot of the content around it, right? So integrated elements, not necessarily the entire site. So where can we target this content? Pretty much anywhere you would think. You know, we can put it on web, we can put it on mobile, embedded, desktop, Windows 8. We're seeing a lot of people building content using CreateJS specifically for Windows 8 now, casual games, that type of thing. And I think another space that's kind of interesting, at least to me, is e-publishing. You're starting to see all of these publishers move their content, so magazines, newspapers, stuff like that, onto digital publishing solutions, like, you know, Adobe has a e-publishing solution. And as they do that and as they become more familiar with the digital space, they're looking more and more at how they can leverage the interactive nature of that space. So instead of just having images, actually having interactive pieces. And so I think there's a lot of space for creating these little interactive bits that do a better job of communicating parts of stories So, for example, mobile, I showed this earlier. But, you know, one of the interesting things about taking the Atari Arcade and making it mobile was that, well, we definitely approached it as a separate project because we really wanted to create a UI that was much more friendly for a small device. We really didn't have to do any work on the games. We just had to make sure that they worked at that size. In some cases, we had to move some of the controls around. But the games performed well on the mobile devices, and we really didn't have to invest a lot of time or money to get this working on mobile. So from the e-publishing perspective, just a really quick little example. When Portal 2 came out, we were approached by an author who was doing the final days of Portal 2, basically tracking the development of the game and talking about what it was. And he wanted us to do a really simple little interactive piece that would show people the dynamic or the physics of Portal. And so you're able to, like, you know, drag this guy into the portal, you know, drop him in, see what he does, and, you know, either get the right height this way, oh, I missed, or you can actually go for the, like, double shot. Oops, missed that too. Not very good at this game. You know, and land him over on the side. And, you know, they could have done this with a static image, but this is digital, right? They can do it with something that's interactive. And this was able to run on iPads and all of their digital targets. So as we started to build out the suite of libraries, I tried to come up with some guiding principles that we could go back to anytime we were trying to make decisions around what we were building. And I came up with four guiding principles. So the first one is that it's approachable, right? Want it to be really easy to use. A lot of open source projects are really hard to get into. And so we worked really hard to make it really well documented, at least by open source standards. We have a lot of examples. And we're actually seeing a lot of tutorials being made around it. And we're trying really hard to make our API make sense to people. So we're borrowing from existing technologies. So if you're a Flash developer, the API is going to look familiar from a Flash perspective. But we've also tried to make it really friendly for JavaScript developers. We want it to be modular. I didn't want this to be one of these monolithic JavaScript libraries where you get stuck taking everything, whether you want it or not. And this is one of my pet peeves when I first started getting into the JavaScript world, was I would find some piece of functionality that I really liked in a library, and I'd wind up getting saddled with 190K of extra stuff that I didn't need because I couldn't figure out how to pull that one little piece out. So all of these libraries work completely independently. You can use them piecemeal, or you can use them together. And we've worked really hard to maintain that independence. There's also a lot of elements inside of the libraries that you can pull out and use on their own. So for example, we have a whole display list and interaction model inside of Easel.js. You can use that as the whole library. But if all you want is an easy way to do vector graphics inside of Canvas, you can pull up just the graphics class, which handles all of our vector graphics, and you can use it completely independently of the rest of the library. In fact, every element in our display list, while most of them aren't quite that independent, every element in the display list can actually be drawn into an arbitrary context. So you don't even have to use our display list. You can just draw pieces of a display list into, say, an Impact.js display list. We want it to be extensible. There's quite a few purpose-built game libraries for JavaScript. And honestly, if you're making a platform game, there's probably a library that does a better job of it than Create.js. What we aim to do is build a core library with general purpose functionality that you can extend to do whatever you want. So we're seeing people build game libraries on top of Create.js. And the reason we took this approach is because I don't want to have to learn five different game libraries to build five different types of games. I want one core piece of knowledge that I can transfer across different types of projects, and then I can add on knowledge to, you know, for example, use the Box2D integration with Create.js, and I can build something out specific to that. Or I can use, there's actually a library for building RPGs on top of Create.js, so I can learn the extension. I don't have to relearn the core technology. And finally, open. You know, we have an open community. It's completely open source, MIT license, so you can basically do whatever you want with it. We've been working really hard to get people involved. I've kind of been the benevolent dictator of the project for a long time, and now we're really working to bring in people, get more people involved with it directly. We're seeing contributions from companies like Zynga, for example, who are, you know, adding their own things into it. And as part of this, of course, we're also reaching out to like big corporations and trying to get them involved with it, right? Because A, they can bring money to the project, which is really valuable. Adobe and Microsoft have both come on as sponsors. And what this has allowed us to do is have a dedicated community manager who's going to be backing this project. We're currently training him up and getting him so that he's in a position so that he can spend a lot of time with the community, help answer questions, help make sure our documentation is top-notch, the type of stuff that's really hard to do when you're just running an open source project and doing it in sort of random time when you have it. And they've also, you know, both Adobe and Microsoft, I should say too, and I'm not trying to suck up because I've already got their money, but they've actually been really great beyond just throwing money at us. I mean, Microsoft has done a lot to sponsor, like to promote CreateJS. They've given us a lot of feedback on what would make it better. Obviously, they have a lot of interest in what will make it run faster on IE, which is fantastic. We get feedback from a lot of different browser vendors, but this has helped cement that relationship. Likewise, Adobe has been really great in talking about the library. They're building tooling around it. So it's a lot of secondary benefits with these relationships. So let's look at the individual libraries. And we're going to spend most of our time on EaselJS because it's both the most mature library and it just does the most stuff, right? So EaselJS is our library for doing 2D graphics. It primarily focuses on canvas. That's why it's called Easel, because it props up your canvas. But it actually, I'll talk about it in a little more depth later on, but we actually are starting to look at other targets as well, other rendering targets as well. And so Easel does a lot of stuff for us. It gives us a display list or a scene graph. Basically, it gives us objects that we can manage and move around. By default, Canvas is a direct draw API, which means that if I draw a circle to a canvas, all it is pixels on the canvas. There's no way to get that circle back out. So EaselJS basically lets me say, I'm going to create a shape that's a circle, and I'm going to put it on my display list, and I can move it around as an object, and I can reference it, and I can take it off my display list, and I can work with everything as objects instead of working with pixels, which is really difficult. Works with a lot of different types of content. It's great with vector graphics, great with bitmaps and bitmap animations, sprite sheet animations. Okay with text. I mean, basic text you can do, but I wouldn't, you know, HTML is fantastic at text. So instead we give you ways of of working with HTML text that's maybe a little bit better than rendering it to canvas. Lots of options for doing animation, movie clips, which we'll talk about at the end, and sprite sheets, which are the core of pretty much every game. And then we have some additional stuff like caching, filters, and masks, which I won't get into in much depth in this talk. But we can do things like blurs and arbitrary shape masking. And I think really importantly, so Canvas, again, only knows about pixels. It has no way of really doing mouse interaction. So we have a whole model built out around mouse interaction. So you don't need to worry about anything. You can just say, you know, mycircle.onclick, and assign a function to it. We also have a multi-touch model, and it works with both iOS-style events, so you know what you're going to see in Android and iPhones, as well as Microsoft's touch model. So it's going to work on Windows Phone 8, Surface tablets, things like that. And you don't have to worry about which one you're working with. You can just use our multi-touch API, and it just works the same way on both. So let's take a quick look at how you actually write code for CreateJS. So it's pretty straightforward. There's really no magic to it. Here I have like a very basic HTML page. I'm embedding the EaselJS library. Oops, sorry about that. And I have a little init function that's going to run on load. And the only thing really in my HTML is this canvas with an ID of demo. The code I have pre-populated in here is creating a new stage. And the stage is basically my base level display object, right? It starts out my display list and it manages a canvas. And I can either pass in a canvas object directly or I can pass in its ID and it'll go out and find it for me. Then I'm creating a text object with the text hello world and setting its font. And then I'm adding that into the stage. So I'm saying render that as a child of the stage. It's being output down here. And we can see our text here. We can see our canvas showing up. But nothing's being rendered. And that's because in EaselJS, we have control over when the stage updates. And that way, we can optimize things. So for example, in that portal infomatic, we don't bother re-rendering if that guy's not moving, right? Whenever the animation stops, we stop rendering the screen. And that way, in an e-publishing environment where I'm probably running on a tablet, we're not using up any CPU cycles when we don't need to, right? We wait for a user interaction. When things are moving around, we update. Otherwise, we stop rendering. So we'll make this change. Oh, I have to reload this because of some weird Safari glitch. So I'm going to comment this out, run this. Now we get our thing rendering. So that's static content, but you know we want to do animated content, right? So one of the things that's included with EaselJS, and which I can optionally use, is the ticker. And the ticker provides me with a heartbeat for my whole game or application. I can write my own heartbeat if I want. The ticker's pretty advanced. It'll work with request animation frame. It'll work with set interval, or set timeout, rather. And it'll manage timing. It'll let me set a frame rate. And so I don't need to worry about that. And it passes me data like elapsed time between frames. So if you don't already have a heartbeat, if you're not already committed to one, you can use Ticker. If you're integrating EaselJS into something like Impact, Impact's a little bit more greedy on what it owns. You can actually use Impact's Ticker instead, which is kind of nice. So all I do is I add the window as a listener, and then I'm going to define a function called Tick. And for now, we'll just say stage.update. Okay, if I reload this, we're not going to see any change. Animation is just change over time. So all I'm going to do is say text.x, you know, advance x by 3 every tick. Run that. Okay, we got a little bit of animation. Let's do something a little bit more fun with y. So we'll say y is equal to math.cos text.x times 0.1 times, say, 15. And we'll try that. Oh, yeah. Now we're getting somewhere exciting. Just to completely do horrible things here, we'll change this color. So CreateJS has a graphics class, and it has a few static methods on it for getting colors. So I'm going to get an HSL color. From some numeric inputs. So I will say a random hue, full saturation, and medium lightness. Oops, what did I do there? Text.color equals graphics like an HSL. This is the lovely thing about writing code on stage, is something inevitably always messes up. We're not erroring out. Text.color equals. Saturation, lightness. All right, I'm going to give up on this instead of subjecting you guys to onstage. Sorry? Yeah, that's fine. Math.random, 360. Yeah. Yeah, I honestly do not see what's going on with this. Text.color. And it is American spelling. It is supposed to be. Anyway, this works, but I've obviously made a onstage typo. I was running it minutes ago, and no problem. I will show you the other thing, which won't look nearly as pretty now, because we're not going to get our beautiful rainbow effect. So another thing that's kind of interesting, especially if you come from a Flash background, is that not only do you control when the stage is drawn, you can also control when the stage is cleared. And so I can, wow. I think what's happening is this is not reloading for some reason. This is a fun thing about custom-made decks. All right, let's just move on. I'm going to work that in a little later and hope that this custom editor doesn't keep doing fun things for me. So let's look at core display classes. Hopefully we get better from here, right? I swear this library works. So we have shape, which contains a graphics object. Graphics object defines vector art. And we can actually reuse graphics classes between multiple shapes, right? So we can have shapes in different positions showing the same vector output. We have bitmaps, static bitmap, bitmap animation, which is an animation based on a sprite sheet. Sprite sheet's just a collection of images inside of often a tile grid. And we just play images from that list in order to get animation. I'll show that in a little more detail in a little bit. We looked at text already. We looked at stage already. And stage actually just extends container. Container is basically our class for aggregating things together and controlling them as one object. We have some other classes, Ticker, which we talked about. We have some sprite sheet helpers. We'll look specifically at sprite sheet builder. Sprite sheet utils lets you do things like pull out individual frames from a sprite sheet. Some math classes, shadows, filters, and DOM element, which we'll talk about, which is kind of an interesting class we'll talk about a little further on. So let's look at bitmap animation. So here we have a sprite sheet image, right? This is a series of individual animation frames that have been put together into a single ping. So I need to define how these frames are laid out. So I can create this sprite sheet data. So I'm creating a new sprite sheet object. I'm passing it in this generic object that's going to define the data for this sprite sheet. I'm pointing it at images. So EaselJS actually has the ability to do multi-image sprite sheets, which is kind of a unique feature. It's really great when you're doing mobile work, because mobile has a maximum texture size, usually about 2048 by 2048. So you can actually have multiple images that that are used as a single sprite sheet. So I'm saying use this sprite sheet, or use this image, and every frame is going to be 117 pixels wide by 125 pixels high, and this is where its center is located. So registration X, registration Y. Then I'm going to define, and so I can do much more in-depth definitions of frames. I can have different variable size frames and stuff like that, but I don't want to write that by hand. So I'll show you some tools that do it for me. And then I'm going to define some animations. So I'm going to say frame 0 to 3 inclusive is a run animation. And when it's done, I want it to loop back and play run again. Then my explode animation is 4 to 10 inclusive. And also when it finishes, I'm going to go back and play the run animation. So here we have our space pig down here running. And you can see to create him, I just said my pig equals a new bitmap animation using that sprite sheet. I can actually chain a lot of stuff together. So here I'm chaining my add child, and it's returning the reference to the thing I added, setting the transform, so x, y, and scale. And finally, go to and play that first animation, the run animation. If I want to make this guy explode, I can take advantage of the mouse interaction model, and I can say pig.onClick equals a function. And I'm just going to say, so we're now in the scope of the pig, so I can say this.goto and play explode. And if I reload this, I click it, we get this nice bacon explosion. But everything's running kind of fast, right? It's a little too fast. So I want to slow this down. So one of the options I have is I can also set the rate that this plays back at. So this is going to play a frame every second tick. And I want a really dramatic explosion. So this will play a frame every 8 ticks. So if I run this now, I get a slower run, and I get a super dramatic exploding pig. So pretty cool. Maybe we should make this pig also moonwalk, because that's critical. So previously I did that using ticker. Doesn't seem like the best way to do it, right? You have to like write everything on your root. So we also distribute an onTick function. It doesn't like it when I don't stick a semicolon there. And this has all the same data with it as the ticker passes through. And I can say this dot x plus equals 3. When I run this, we get our moonwalking pig, who can still explode. But then he reappears. I don't really like that. So I'm going to say this dot on animation ended, I believe. This dot stop. And we'll do this dot parent dot remove child this. So hopefully this works. Let's get the name of this. Oh, see, I always get this name wrong. There we go. Right? So when I click it, it's going to go to and play explode. It's going to set up a listener for when the explode animation finishes. When it finishes, I'll stop it so that it doesn't go back and play the run again. I could also change my data up here to stop it from looping. And then I'm going to remove it from its parent. So now it's going to be eligible to get cleaned up, right? I'll show you one more thing while we're on the subject. So ticker passes a delta time to the display list when it calls it. Actually, anything that listens on ticker will get the delta time passed to it. And the display list will automatically propagate forward any parameters when it gets ticked. So I wind up with this delta time getting passed through to my onTick function. And this means that I can use time-based animation. So I can say, time divided by 1,000 gives me my time in seconds times, 100. So now I can change my frame rate, or I can have variable frame rates, right? If something takes a long time, I have a lot of processing going on, and this speed is always going to be the same. His animation speed is always going to be the same because I'm using the elapsed time between my last tick and my current tick. And so this makes it really easy to work with time-based animation. Let's look at a little bit more advanced interaction. So something like drag and drop. So I want to be able to do this kind of thing. So I'm creating a new bitmap, sticking it on the stage, setting up its initial parameters, and then I'm adding some listeners in here. So the first thing I'm doing is I'm listening on press. And when that event gets fired, I'm going to get a mouse event object back. And in EaselJS, mouse event objects have a really interesting property where they actually have their own mouse events exposed on them, only for press events, though. And these events only happen for the duration of that press, which makes it really easy to do things like drag and drop, because you can just say, when I get pressed, I'm going to listen to mouse move, and I know that I don't have to clean up, because as soon as it's released, the mouse move on this event is going to get released, and it's never going to fire again. The other thing that's really cool with this is when we get into multi-touch, and I wish I could say I planned this from day one, but it just kind of turned out really well. When we added multi-touch into this, it means that you have a context for the current touch that's going on. I don't need to check the touch ID or anything like that while I'm handling these mouse moves and mouse ups. Easel does that for me. I can just say, when something gets pressed, for its event, I'm going to do mouse moves and mouse ups, and it'll stick to that single touch, right? We manage the touch ID in the background, and we only associate these moves and mouse ups with the touch that triggered the on press. That make sense? So we were actually able to, like a demo like this, if I want this to be multi-touch, it's done. This is now multi-touch. If I had multiple daisies on screen now, I could grab them with individual fingers and move them around without writing any more code. I don't have to worry about touch IDs or anything. I can also enable touch and say I want to use only single touch if that's what I'd prefer. So that's press and move. We also have on click. Mouse over and mouse out are a little bit trickier. What is going on here? Oh, because I... Let's take that out. So I've just put on mouse over and on mouse out event handlers, but you can see they're not actually doing anything yet. The reason for this is that calculating on mouse over and mouse out is kind of expensive. Not crazy expensive, but it definitely means that as the mouse moves, we're having to do some work to figure out what it's over or what it's left. So we make it optional whether or not this gets turned on. So you can basically say stage.enable mouse over equal. And now when we run this, you can see I'm getting that alpha effect. You can barely see it on that projector, but you can see that the alpha decreases when I roll over and then goes back when I roll out. We also give you a little parameter so that you can set how often this happens. So I could like do something silly like this. And now you can see there's like that big delay. I basically said, check once a second. So there's going to be up to a second delay before it actually responds to any movements. And this lets me, you know, so I could set this really high and have it be really, really responsive. But I want to find sort of a happy medium between what feels good from a UI perspective versus what's taking a lot of processing power to actually compute. One other thing that we wanted to enable and make really easy was when I drag off of a canvas, it'd be nice if I kept getting data about what's going on, right? I could make this thing continue to follow the mouse so that if I'm trying to position this near the edge, I don't keep losing it and having to keep jumping back up. So again, we give you an option to say stage dot mouse move outside equals true. And now when I drag, it's still going to follow me even when I'm outside of my canvas. And it's nice because mouse event actually has two sets of coordinates on it. It has stage x and stage y, which are always normalized within the boundaries of the canvas. And then we have raw x and raw y, which are still relative to the origin of the canvas, but it means that we can get negative values out here. So we could, you know, drag this thing out. But obviously, sometimes that'll mess up your calculations if you're suddenly getting negative values where you don't expect them. Oh, one other thing I should mention quickly, or two things maybe. In the upcoming version of EaselJS, so we always have a next build ongoing, right? Which is whatever, we don't have a version number for it yet. We've actually added more robust events. So I can say things like daisy.addEventListener. Listener, click through this, right? So this way I can have multiple subscribers for the same click event. We were also adding a class called Button Helper, which just works like this, and it'll work with any bitmap animation or movie clip. And you can optionally define what frames to go to. So I could do this. By default, it'll try and go to a label of, you know, out, over, down. And you can also define a hit area. And it'll do hand cursors on things. So makes it really easy to, like, set up button-type interactions. So... again, Canvas is just one piece of the puzzle. One of the cool things about HTML is that we have a lot of different surfaces that we can use. You know, Canvas is one, WebGL is one, SVG is another. HTML, obviously, is a surface on its own. And they all have different strengths. And so we want to really take advantage of the strengths of different surfaces. And so we do this in basically everything that we build. So, you know, this is a game that we built a little while ago called Tankster. All of this UI is all HTML. Now, why recreate the stuff in Canvas when HTML does such a great job of having interactive elements, showing text, all that kind of stuff? When we get into the game itself, know, everything around here is HTML, including, you know, these characters and stuff. The game engine itself, all the terrain, the background, the tanks, the shots, that's all inside of Canvas. It's all managed by Easel.js. And then we have these health bubbles. And the health bubbles display a little bit nicer, and we have a little more control over, like, the styles and stuff like that if we do it in HTML. But we really need them to be synced up with the content that we have inside of our game engine, right? The content that we're displaying in our Easel.js display list. And so to facilitate these types of requirements, we have this special display object called DOM element. And basically, DOM element lets me take anything in the HTML body and associate it with the display object inside of my Easel.js display list. And then it'll be transformed. It'll have things like alpha and visibility set on it as though it were living inside of that same display list. It's not going to be layered correctly, right? It's either going to be above or below the canvas, but it is going to alpha out, and it is going to get moved around, rotated, skewed, all those types of things. And so this works out really well. So for example, here's our friendly pig, and I can bring up this speech bubble, and you can see that he's running into the end of the canvas and being cut off, but this is an HTML element. You can see that all I've done is added it as a child of the container that holds both the pig animation and that HTML speech bubble. And so I can leverage things like, you know, links, for example, which I would have to write a bunch of code to do in Canvas, but which I get for free in HTML. I don't know what this thing is. This freaks me out every time I... so this is really cool. It lets us take advantage of the best parts of these different rendering surfaces. This is actually another site by Periscopic, and you can see that they're doing a really nice job of leveraging this, right? You could do this in Canvas, but it's going to be a pain, whereas HTML makes this so easy. It makes it so easy to restyle, so easy to work with, and so all of these little bugs running around are all in Canvas being done with Easel.js. And then they're associating bubbles and placing them as DOM elements. Another thing that we've been working on in this space, you know, leveraging different surfaces, is multi-surface renderers for Easel.js. The idea behind this is that you can write your content once on top of Easel.js, and then you can choose what surface to render it to. So if you're targeting a mobile device that has WebGL support, and the WebGL support is a lot faster than its Canvas support, you could render it to WebGL. If you're targeting a really old mobile device and the DOM is faster than Canvas, you can target the DOM. So as an example, so this is running inside of the Canvas, right, which is where we expect Easel.js content to run. Let's run in WebGL. This is running in WebGL. I can't really prove that to you without jumping into the inspector, but this is now WebGL. And this one I can actually prove to you. So this is the HTML DOM. You can see that I can just pull pieces of him off, because in the DOM, these are just image tags, right? Just images that I can pull off. I can also, like, try and select him. And so I was able to write this content once with a single dynamic line of code that all it does is swap the renderer. It all renders out. I don't even have to change my surface manually. I just ask the renderer plugin for the surface, and then I insert it into my DOM. And it'll pass back whatever is appropriate. You know, a canvas if I'm doing WebGL or Context2D, a div if it's doing HTML, or an SVG wrapper if I'm doing SVG. Honestly, right now, there's not a huge value in using these. But I, you know, it's kind of an interesting experiment to me, and I like to be forward-looking. Canvas is getting really fast. It's really well accelerated by pretty much every modern browser. And so even WebGL doesn't really seem to offer a big performance value, right? Because the optimizations you'd have to do to make a renderer that's really fast, 2D renderer that's really fast on WebGL, are the exact same optimizations that these big multi-billion dollar companies building browsers have to do to make Canvas 2D run fast, right? So, but it's still, I think it's good to have those options. We support a filter model. Filters are pretty slow, so We recommend them as something that you run once just to get the effect that you want, not something that you animate, because these are working on pixels, right? They're actually having to run through the pixels and operate individually. So, you know, things like blurs, color effects, you know, that type of thing. This is actually a color transform. It's actually really green on my screen, and it looks almost identical on that screen. Filters are pretty easy to work with. You basically just create a new filter, apply it back into your display object's filter list. So here I'm saying I'm only have one filter inside of my list. It's a color matrix filter. It's using this color matrix. And this is my hue shift, so 180-degree hue shift. So basically invert my colors, or invert my hue. You'll notice that this actually isn't applying yet. And that's because we only apply filters when you cache a shape. Caching is basically saying, I want to take this display object, and I want to render it out to a separate canvas. And then I just want you to blit it from off-screen back into the canvas. You can use this for performance reasons. You know, for example, if you have very complex vector art or you have really deep containers, very deep display lists that aren't changing, then you can cache them, and it'll just create a bitmap representation of it. You can actually even set a scale for your cache so that if you are going to need to rotate it or scale it in or out, you can actually pre-cache it so that you have extra data to work with. But we also use this for doing our filters, because to run these filters, we need access to the bitmap data, and so we make sure that you have to cache this before you actually put your filters on. So we can make our filters dynamic if we want. Again, this isn't doing anything yet, and that's because we need to update our cache whenever we want it to re-render the filters. So, you know, now we have a dynamic filter. Again, I don't really recommend something like this because running this is fairly expensive, right? We're having to iterate through all those pixels every time the mouse moves. Not the best option generally, but still really great for things like you think of a game scenario where you have, you know, the red team versus the blue team. You can take a sprite sheet, pre-transform it using filters, and then use the output as a as your blue team sprite sheet, for example. Or if you just want to, like, do a desaturated to saturated image. You can do that very easily. And then if you want the nice fade between those two, instead of fading the filter itself, you can just crossfade the desaturated output against the saturated version. So let's look at another library, TweenJS. So that was the big library. Don't worry, we're not going to take as long on these other libraries. So TweenJS, I've written a lot of tweening libraries over the years, almost all of them in ActionScript. And they're one of those things that I really find fun. In ActionScript, I tend to focus a lot on, like, really object-oriented tweening libraries. With TweenJS, it was kind of a fun challenge for me because I got to get in and write, like, a really JavaScript-friendly tweening engine, something that's really loose, has a very limited API, but it's also super powerful. And I had a lot of fun with this thing. So here, super simple code. Creating a circle inside of a shape, putting it on the stage, placing it on a certain location, it's here, adding a label in, setting initial text, font, and position. So we get this, static. Now we're going to animate it using tween. So let's start really simple. I'm getting a tween that's targeting my ball, and I'm going to animate it to a Y position of 200. So animate it down here over the course of 2 seconds, and I'm going to use an ease equation, bounce out. So then instead of just a linear motion, I'm going to have some nice bounce to the motion. I'll run that. All right, if you've ever used a tweening library, looks really familiar. Where it gets more interesting is when we start chaining. So I can just start calling stuff on this tween, and it'll create this chain of functionality. So now I'm saying, do all that stuff. Then I want you to set the text on my label to wait. I want you to wait 1 second, change the text to fade. Then I want you to tween to an alpha of 0 over the course of 1 second. Then I want you to set the text to done, wait for a half a second. And then I want you to call the function alert on the scope window with the parameters all done. If I don't set this, it'll try and call it on my target, right? So That's why we need that last parameter. If I run this, wait, fade, done, and alert. Right? So essentially a single line of code that's defining a fairly complex behavior. But I can take this further too. I can actually create interactions between different tweens. So I'm going to, I want my label to start out alpha to out. And I want to fade my label in, and then I want to run this main tween. So I'm going to say createJS.tween.get my label. And I'm going to say to an alpha of 1 over the course of 2 seconds. And then I want you to play my main tween. And the only other thing I have to do here is I need to make sure that my initial tween, the tween on the ball, starts out paused. So I'm going to pass it in a tween property, and I'm going to say, I want you to start out paused. Now, if this all works for us, paused, the fade ends, it calls the other tween, and we create this nice sequence of tweens. And they can actually call back and forth between each other. You know, this tween could actually have a pause on it. And it could pause itself, and then this guy could play it, and then this guy could then tell this to play later on. And you can get, or you could have them loop between each other, where this guy, when he finishes, calls that guy and calls play on it. And then you'd get those two looping around each other. So you can do really complex stuff with an API that's only like 5 or 6 methods deep. And to me, this is really fun to put together. One other thing I was going to mention, just because I thought of it. So this is, CrateJS lives inside of a package so that it doesn't collide with other libraries. But you can override this anytime you want. So you can actually, before you load CrateJS scripts, you can actually say CrateJS equals window, and you don't have any package. Or you can say, you know, var c equals CrateJS, and then it's just c dot whatever. So lots of functionality in this. TweenJS includes a timeline class that lets you take a bunch of tweens, stick them all together, and treat them as though they were a single aggregate tween, so basically creating a timeline of tweens. You saw easing, you saw sequencing, you saw us dealing with non-numeric props, so you can set things like false and true, text values, and basically those just get set at the end of the tween. So you can actually do things like have lights blinking on and off by setting their visibility on and off and setting a time for that. We can do overriding, so you can have one tween running and then start another tween and tell it to override any previous tweens. Things I think are most interesting, though, are these tweens are fully deterministic, which basically means that I can set up one of these really complex tweens and I can say, go to 3 seconds in, and it'll render the same thing at 3 seconds in every time. And that means that I can do things like set up a tween to transition in an interface or something. And I can say, actually, I don't want to run that this time. I'm just going to skip to the end of this animation, and I know that it's going to be the way I want it to be. It's also, again, we really aim for extensibility, and so it has a plugin model. So TweenJS doesn't know anything about CSS, for example. I mean, its primary target is EaselJS. EaselJS is all numeric properties. CSS has all these other things you need to worry about, right? It has to use strings. We have different units on it, right? Pixel, EM, stuff like that. And so we actually ship alongside TweenJS the CSS plugin. And all you do is install the CSS plugin on TweenJS. And then it can deal with CSS properties as well. It can animate DOM elements. And you can, you know, write plugins to do whatever you want. Next library is SoundJS. And so audio on the web is a total mess. It's really hard to work with, all kinds of headaches. And so we set out to try and make it, you know, more usable. It's still not completely usable, but it's becoming more usable. And so SoundJS actually has a very simple API in terms of what it does. It lets you prep sounds, play sounds, set volume, set panning, fairly basic capabilities. But it abstracts that API out from all of these different methods of playing sound online and makes it so you don't need to worry about what your browser is actually doing. So This is how it works. We basically have a series of plugins, and you can write your own plugins as well. Right now, we have HTML audio plugin and the Flash plugin. We also have a web audio plugin that was contributed by Zynga that we're currently vetting and updating for the next release. And basically, you say, I'm going to register a list of plugins. SoundJS will go through. It'll try and figure out, in order, which one is going to work. Pick the first one that's going to work for it for this environment. And that's what it's going to use from now on. You don't need to know what it chose, but if you're interested, you can ask for capabilities. So for example, if it wound up using HTML audio, HTML audio doesn't support panning. So you can say get capabilities.pan, and it'll tell you whether or not panning is supported. You can still do panning, and it'll just fail silently, because most sound operations aren't critical, right? We still want to play your sound. We still want your game to run. If your panning doesn't work, your game's still going to be fine, right? So, but if you want to know if it'll work, you can check. And we have global functions. You know, you can set a global volume, for example. When you play a sound, you're going to get back a sound instance. You can do things like change its volume, change its pan, pause it, listen for when it completes. And again, without having to worry about what's going on in the background. Is Flash playing this audio? Is HTML playing this audio? Who cares, right? As long as SoundJS is managing it for you. So, super lame demo.
Reporting aboard!
Audio in the web browser. But you can obviously do much more advanced stuff than this. I mean, all of our games use SoundJS under the hood. And I should mention, too, that, again, with web audio, the web audio plugin coming, iOS 6, which iOS has been horrible for sound on the web, iOS 6 actually has web audio support. And so we actually, with the new web audio plugin, we've tested, and we have audio working on iOS now as well, which to us is huge, because our clients are always asking why the games don't have sound on iOS. Just for the hell of it, I thought I'd show you a silly little experiment that I did. This is actually getting kind of old, but I still think it's kind of fun. So I really wanted to I really like doing like music visualizers. And so when we were building this library, I wanted to like build a music visualizer. At the time, this was before web audio. And web audio still isn't everywhere, right? Like, i.e. But web audio is obviously gaining traction. And so with web audio, you're actually able to sample the volume levels and spectrum and stuff like that. But back then, you couldn't do it. So I built this little application that would read in a MP3, and it would generate out an image that represented peak volume data for like every 20th of a second, I think. So every single one of these pixels, the red codes for the left channel, the blue codes for the right channel. And so I load this into Canvas, and I grab the pixel data, and I read through these pixels as I play the music, and I can keep this data synced with the position in the audio. And you get something like this. Oh, man, this is going to look horrible on the screen. I don't know if this is worth it. Anyway, imagine the coolest thing you can possibly imagine. That's what's going on right here. This is on our website. It's not worth it on this thing to actually show it. But to me, it's kind of cool that you can sort of pull these things together in ways that you didn't necessarily expect and get kind of interesting results. So final library, and this is actually the last library that we built, is Preload.js, right? You know, we have our 2D graphics, we have our sound, we have animation, but we really need to pull all this stuff in before we can display anything. And so we built Preload.js. And basically, it lets you create load queues. You can have multiple load queues. And you can add things in, either individually or via manifest. So this is a simple manifest that just says, I want this queue to load an image, some data, some scripting, maybe a sound. And I want to know the progress for all of this load. If available, Preload.js will use XHR2. And XHR2 gives us real progress. So we'll actually give you granular progress on these loads. If XHR2 isn't supported, we fall back on tag-based loading. And we basically just try and fake the progress. So you're still going to get OK progress, but it's not going to be as real or as pretty as if we have XHR2. But again, this is the whole idea of these libraries, is that you don't really need to worry about what's available to you. It's going to do the best thing it possibly can. And then, you know, we can listen for things like when the queue completes. We can actually listen for when individual files load, and then we can deal with the result as it comes in. So, for example, you might want to push all of your images as they come in into a like library object that'll hold them all. It supports plugins. Again, we want this to be extensible. And we take really major advantage of that with SoundJS. So if you have both of these libraries installed, then SoundJS will actually register itself as a plugin to PreloadJS. And when you load sounds with PreloadJS, it'll actually ask SoundJS to handle it. And the reason for that, and they actually have this very complex relationship where if it's using HTML audio, SoundJS will actually say, nah, you can handle it. I'll deal with it when the load is done. If it's using Flash, though, we don't want PreloadJS to understand anything about dealing with Flash. So our Flash audio plugin actually deals with telling Flash how to preload these assets, listens for the progress inside of Flash, and funnels that progress back into preload so that you get one aggregate progress. And you get your complete when everything is done, whether it's loading in Flash or whether it's loading in the browser. So this is pretty powerful. And finally, you can use these queues as basically asset libraries. So when everything's done loading, you know, you can break them out and stick them into different places, or you can keep them here, access this queue, pull out the assets as you need them based on, so when you define a manifest or when you tell something to load, you can give it an ID. By default, if you don't, it'll just use the name of the file, like the full URL to the file. So if you associate an ID, it's really easy to come back in and say, get result giraffe, and you get out the picture of the giraffe you loaded earlier. So I'm not going to show you a demo because watching a progress bar is really boring. But so that's the four libraries in the suite, and that's great. It you know it empowers developers to build cool content, but to build awesome content you need designers involved, and none of this addresses getting designers involved. So this is something that we've been tackling over the last couple years as well, is what kind of tools can we create or work with other companies to create to empower designers to get involved in this process? Obviously, sprite sheets often form a really large part of what we want to do, especially when we're building games. And so there's a bunch of tools that support sprite sheet creation. Texture Packer will export to EASL.js. I think they finally fixed it. They kept calling us EasyJS, which you know, maybe it's a compliment, I don't know. Flash Pro has built-in support for exporting EASL.js sprite sheets. Their current support is a version behind on EASL.js. We changed a little bit about how sprite sheets worked, but they'll still export the sprite sheets, and you can do a little bit of tweaking to get them to work in the latest version, and we'll be working with Adobe to make sure that that's updated. And then we have our own tool that we built called Zoe, and I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more depth. So Zoe is kind of similar to the Flash Pro solution in that it'll take Flash content and it'll build sprite sheets out of it. Our animators are really familiar with working with Flash Pro, great animation tool, nice way to organize assets. And so we wanted to leverage that experience. And this was before there was a sprite sheet builder inside of Flash Pro itself. So we built Zoe, and Zoe basically just takes an existing Swift. So in this case, this is some of the assets that we used in Atari Arcade. And our illustrator has just laid them out however he wants. And we can pull this into Zoe. And Zoe's going to go through this timeline, find the boundaries of everything that it can see on stage. We have ways of defining the origin point, so the registration point. And we can tweak this. We can manually set our boundaries if we want. But we can also do some kind of interesting stuff. So we can choose whether or not we want a fixed frame width and height, so just a single tile grid, or whether we want variable frames, in which case it'll try and do optimal packing. And we have this really nice feature where you can variably tell it to reuse frames. So the higher I set this, the less similar two frames need to be reused. Often when animators are working, they'll create frames that are very similar to each other, not really able to be differentiated. Maybe they just moved it half a pixel for the end frame versus the first frame. And we actually do some use some image logic and find the difference between every frame, and we'll reuse any frames that are similar. And this lets, in Atari, it let us reduce the number of sprites in a sprite sheet by anywhere from like 10 to 30%, depending on what we were doing. And that has a significant file size saving. When we're all ready, we can hit export here. We can also tell it what our maximum resolution is going to be. And this will, just like EaselJS, this will support multiple images in a single sprite sheet. So if I'm targeting mobile, even if I have a lot of assets, I can go 2048 by 2048. And if it has to, it'll create multiple images to support the sprite sheet. I hit export, and this is going to spit out. Let's see if I just do this. I don't know where this is going to export right now. So this is now, you can actually see it running through every frame down here. And it's going to dump out a JavaScript file here, which has all the frames defined, so our images, our frames, and it's read in all of our animations as well, right? All of the labels from the Flash content. And then it also, of course, generates the actual sprite sheet that we need, right? So I can now suck this in, that code, this image, and I have a working sprite sheet. And this is all open source, so you can like take it, do whatever you want, modify it to work in your workflow. We also have a JSFL file on the blog, gskinner.com/blog. That JSFL file makes it easier to work with multiple elements because it only reads the main stage timeline. And so we have a JSFL that makes it easier to distribute multiple elements across the stage so that you can have lots of symbols and export them all to the same sprite sheet. So we built Zoe, and we're like, all right, that gets us part of the way to where we want to be. But we also want to be able to output vector content, and we want to be able to output real runtime tweens and animations. And so about a year ago, I sat down, I started playing around with building a custom panel for Flash that would export, export our content as actual JavaScript code that would run inside of Easel. So we'd actually preserve the vectors and preserve the animations. And I showed this to Adobe, and Adobe went, that's fucking awesome. Can we work with you on that? And I said, yes. And so over the last year, we have been maturing it, making it better. I think the most important thing to point out is that this isn't an exporter. This is not a push a button and your old Flash game is going to run in HTML. I'm not a believer in that workflow. Adobe tried that with Wallaby. I don't know, anyone try playing with Wallaby? Anyway, so Wallaby was that. It was supposed to be a push a button, and it'll convert all your action script and all of your assets, and it'll spit out this beautiful HTML5 thing. And surprise, surprise, Wallaby worked to 95%, and they couldn't get the last 5% working. And the stuff that it output was black box code. You did not want to go inside there and try and edit anything. It was unusable, and it was huge, you know, really big exports. This is a new publishing workflow. We basically restrict what you can do inside of Flash Pro so that we can output really readable, really usable code and keep the output really small. And there's not that many restrictions, but there's a few things we don't support. So stuff that we do support, any bitmap content, text to a limited degree. Again, Canvas is pretty limited with what we can do with text, so we don't support everything with text. Pretty much all vector art. A few of the filters, we support groups, we support movie clips, we support graphic symbols, all of your motion tweens. In fact, we support all the different types of tweens right now, but only classic motion tweens are preserved as runtime tweens. Everything else, just like Flash does when it generates a SWIFT, everything else is blocked into frames. We support labels on your timelines. You can actually have sounds on your timeline, and they'll export correctly. And we actually let you write JavaScript on the timeline. So if you like writing timeline action script, we have a kind of simplistic method for letting you write a little bit of JavaScript on the timeline and have it injected into this, this timeline. We don't read your code. Converting ActionScript to JavaScript is stupid. I mean, it's not really stupid. There are solutions that kind of do it well, but it's not the workflow that we wanted. We wanted to be able to build best-of-breed applications and games, and you can't do that if a machine is writing your code. We use this to get our assets out, and then we write great JavaScript code in whatever IDE we want to write it in. If you're writing a ton of ActionScript in your timeline, you're probably doing it wrong anyway. And so this is a way of either leveraging existing capability in your design department to create new assets for new games, or to take old assets for existing games and write JavaScript around it and create new versions of the games in JavaScript. These two things are the things that I've had a really big focus on. The code is totally readable, totally easy to go in and edit yourself. You know, this code can be a starting point, not necessarily an end point. You can, like, export a bunch of content and then go back in and manipulate it later on if you want to by hand. You don't always need to be going back to the tool to get your JavaScript out. Yeah, I think the ceiling is going to collapse on us. But, and, you know, I've been doing this work for well over a decade, and the designer-developer workflow is really important to me, and I did a lot of work to try and make sure that there was a strong story around how this stuff works, and I'll show you it in action in just a second. So let me actually show you this stuff working. So let's take a look at our friendly robot that we saw earlier. So this is a simple animation. I have this robot. I have a background. The robot is it's got some sounds on the timeline. It has a bunch of timeline animations that my illustrator put together. And at the end of this, we actually have a little bit of JavaScript. And so this is how we insert JavaScript using Toolkit. We'll ignore any ActionScript that you put in, but any comments with this structure we'll inject as JavaScript. And so this is going to say, when I hit this frame, I'm going to go to and stop hello. I'm going to set the text of this speech bubble to hello HTML5. And if I get a click, so we're in this, which is the robot, if I click on the robot, I'm going to alert restart and go to and play start. All I do now is hit the publish button inside of this panel. And oops, this is my debug mode. It's under active development. And you can hear the sounds playing, you know, the animations are working. And my code ran hello HTML5. I return to that position. If I click him, restart. Right? If we look at the code that came out of this, it's very object-based. So everything that we create is basically an instantiable object, and it represents everything that was in my timeline. So there's a lot of, like, sort of garbage almost around it. But so these are the bitmap objects that were in my library. So they're very simple. It's basically just saying, grab this image out of my image library and create a new bitmap object out of this. And I can at any point say, new head jaw, and I will get that bitmap. But we look at something like the robot. So this is an instantiable object, robot underscore one. It's called that because my main stage is also called robot, because FLA is called robot. And basically, what we're doing is we're defining the timeline functions that existed in this FLA. We're defining each layer individually. So this is an actions tween, which is an aggregate of all the actions on all my layers. And then this is the speech bubble label. So we've taken the name of that layer and stuck it in as a comment for you. And so, okay, there's a bubble. It's a library item. This is position. It's alpha. It's initially hidden. And then we have a tween, which defines that timeline, right? So we have things like weights and tweens to and stuff like that. And so we can go in and edit any of this stuff. Like, we can say, my robot dot forearm L dot visible equals false, and we're going to hide his arm. But we can also use these things as objects. So I'm going to pull in, oops, not the FLA. That wouldn't go well. Ah, everything's going everywhere. So I'm going to pull in the HTML that it wrote, and I'm also going to pull in a little bit of pre-written code. The HTML, also quite readable. We're grabbing our canvas. We're setting up an images library. We have a manifest of everything that's going to get loaded. We're creating a preload.js queue. passing in the manifest, listening for when it's done. We're taking advantage of that on-file loaded method to basically shunt all the images into this like images library as they load. And when we're done, we're just instantiating the main root timeline and adding it onto the stage, and then setting up our ticker, which is using the frame rate from my FLA. So I can come in here and grab some code here, paste this in. Basically, the main thing that I want to demonstrate here is that I can reach into that library and I can instantiate these things as objects. So I can just say, give me a new robot one, and it'll pass back a new one of those objects, and I can just add it into a container, and it's going to display. So basically, I'm saying, get a new robot, set it at a certain location, add a tween to it. You'll see the tween run when I actually do this. Basically, just spreads them out from the center, and then go to and play a frame between 0 and 19, right? So they're all going to start slightly offset, and add it onto my root. And if I run this, so I save that, we get this little robot chorus line going on. And so you can see how this isn't just exporting a black box of code. This is exporting a library of assets that I can use whatever I want, right? And each one of these, I believe, will actually run completely independently, right? Okay, so human-readable code. And then we have this workflow. So you saw there, I generated this preview HTML. I generated a JavaScript library that held all those symbols. I obviously have an FLA. My designer can own the FLA as a developer. I don't need anything to do with it. I might pop over and help him define labels or maybe add little bits of code onto the timeline that just tell me when certain things happen. But generally, I'm never going to have to touch this FLA. Likewise, I'm probably never going to touch this preview HTML, right? This is just so that the designer can see what's going on with this file. As a developer, the designer can check this into version control or email it to me or whatever he wants, and I can consume this into my own deploy HTML and write my own JavaScript logic that's going to run a game or an experience around it. And this leaves my designer free to update the assets whenever he wants, send me this file however he wants, and I just have to consume that back in, and I'm going to see the changes right away. So let me show this to you in action. Okay. So, you know, I decide I want to build this simple game, and this is a very simple game for the sake of illustration. So I go to my designer. I'm like, I want to build this game. This is kind of what it's going to be like. Can you get me some art that I can start working from? And my designer takes an hour, sketches some stuff up. You know, this is roughly what I think it's going to be. And I work with him for a little bit to like set some labels. You know, these are what the actions are going to be. Let's put these labels in so that we're ready to go. And you know, so for example, I know that I'm going to want this guy to like, you know, have an idle state, and I know that I want him to swim. So I'm going to say, okay, like, let's put in these labels and sketch it up as fast as you can. So he passes this off to me, publishes it off, and where did my browser go? There we go. Publishes it off. He can look at this. This is his preview HTML. He can tell it's working, and he can hand me that JavaScript file. I can set up my own HTML, and I can consume that file, right? So I'm bringing in demo sketch, which is that library file that was generated, and I'm also bringing in octogame.js, along with all of the crate.js libraries. And then I can go in and I can write all of my logic separate from anything that he's doing inside of my own JavaScript. And, you know, I'm not going to go into this a lot, but basically I'm not using anything from that preview. I'm just reaching in and grabbing assets as I need them, right? So grab some seaweed, stick it on the bottom, you know, grab the background, stick it where I need it, create the octopus down here, stick it where I need it. You know, I'm not worrying about the details of how these things look. I'm just using them as assets. And, you know, I can build out a game on this, right? So I have my, I don't know what this game does exactly. That's all it does. But you can see I have my little animated seaweed that's been randomly distributed. I have my interactive octopus. ready to go. But then my designer can say, okay, I actually have some time now. I'm going to come in here, and I am going to clean this stuff up for you. And so, you know, I cheat because I can't draw. Not to mention, you probably don't want to sit here watching me draw for the next 2 hours. So all I'm going to do is I'm going to go in and just turn off some layers and turn on some other layers. Oops. Yeah, that's what I want to do. And my designer can work on this for as long as they want. Safari doesn't always reload. My designer can work on this for as long as they want and get it to the state that they want. And when they're ready, they can shoot me back this JS file. And what do I need to do? I don't need to do anything. I'll just reload my game. And there we go. Now the assets are in here, right? And he could have changed the length of timelines, done whatever he wanted, as long as the labels were intact. This game would just keep running. So really nice decoupling of the design side and the developer side of how you build JavaScript games. Works on devices, so mobile and tablets and stuff like that. We, about 2 months ago, released version 1.1, which added things like mask support, including animated masks, shape tweens, support for the like new style motion tweens in Flash. Gave you some additional options, like the ability to configure the namespaces that it uses. And we added, it's a lot faster, and we added this kind of seemingly useless feature called multi-frame bounds, which will export an array of all the boundaries of the frames within a movie clip. And we did that for a very specific purpose, and that was to enable runtime sprite sheets. And this is a feature that I've been really passionate about and really have been wanting to get in. So basically, within Easel.js, we have this class called Sprite Sheet Builder. And you can add whatever you want into it, any kind of display object. So you could do some vector graphics and add it in. You could take an existing bitmap and add it in. And you can add movie clips from Toolkit in. And what this will do is take everything that you add and either synchronously, so all at once, or asynchronously, using green threading, it will generate out a sprite sheet for you that you can use at runtime. So now we get file size benefits from using vector art and using runtime animations and the ability to manipulate these things at runtime with the performance benefits of sprite sheets. So it's going to run really fast on mobile devices. We also get this really neat side benefit of being able to dynamically scale these sprite sheets. So if I load this up on a desktop device, I could go for full scale and get a big sprite sheet out of it. If I load this up on a mobile device, I might say, well, actually, I'm going to scale this down for this use case. I'm going to get a smaller sprite sheet that might perform a little bit better and that's more appropriate for the resolution I'm running at. And so what this lets us do is it lets us load in those JavaScript libraries, start running Sprite Sheet Builder while we go out and load other things, like the audio and stuff. And hopefully those two things sync up fairly closely so that by the time we're done loading our other assets, we have this runtime sprite sheet built. And we can also cache that out using local storage, so we only have to do this once, and it's going to be available to us the next time our game runs. So this is how it looks. This is running asynchronously. So this is the movie clip that came out of Toolkit. This is the bitmap animation. All my labels are intact. This is the sprite sheet that was generated out of it. And when that ran, you could probably see that because this is asynchronous, it's running through these things one at a time or a few at a time. And basically, what I can tell it is use half of my available CPU to do this rendering. And that way, my UI will remain responsive. Or use 10% of my available CPU. And so I can really control how quickly it renders versus how responsive my UI remains. So this to me, again, this is like really exciting. Sorry, I'm like hyped about this stuff because I'm super disappointed by how big HTML5 games are. You know, I come from a Flash background, and like I'm an old school Flash guy. Like if it can't be done in 100K, it's not worth doing. And pretty much every HTML5 game I've ever seen is 10 megs plus. The Atari games, we worked really hard with the sprite sheets to optimize them, to cull unused frames, that kind of stuff. And most of those games sit around 2 or 3 megabytes. with this stuff, which is what we're hoping to use in all of our future projects. So that, if I just loaded that sprite sheet, 2.5 megabytes. Generating the JavaScript, and then over the wire, it's going to be zlib. Almost every server will zlib textual content, 19K. So 99% reduction in file size, and with Spritesheet, with the Spritesheet Builder doing runtime sprite sheets, same performance as if we had loaded that full sprite sheet. So to me, that's like super exciting. And the output that we're getting on Toolkit, I mean, it's variable. It's not always going to be smaller than Swift, but sometimes it is. Like, this blows me away. I mean, this is a Swift. We didn't do any special work on it. It's just something that Adobe provided us. You know, the zipped version of this, not counting the libraries, is 9K. The original Swift was 37K. And this is because we actually preserve runtime tweens, whereas Flash breaks down the individual frames. You know, this guy is about half the size. This guy uses a lot of complex vectors. Every single frame is a redrawn version of this guy's body. We're not quite as small when it comes to putting in a lot of vector data. But you can see that it's starting to open up so that we can create comparably sized content to what we used to be able to do in the Flash world. So we've had a lot of contributions, a few that I'd like to just point out that I think are pretty cool. I mentioned the web audio plugin that Zynga contributed, and I'm excited about this because it gives us iOS support for audio. CreateFL is actually done by Periscopic, who are the guys that did those visualizations, so both the global hand-washing day visualization and the HP grants visualization. CreateFL, so IE8 is the biggest thorn in our side right now because it doesn't have Canvas support. And CreateFL basically lets you use the Flash player to render a lot of this content out. An old friend of mine, Amit Pitaro, has been doing a lot of work with CreateJS, and he's been working on bringing CreateJS into the Ejecta framework. Ejecta works with ImpactJS to let you write JavaScript content and cross-compile it for iOS. So basically, as this project matures, you'll be able to create JS content and actually create a native iOS application, not just a wrapped iOS application. Whether or not that's a better approach, we'll see. I don't know. But it's still kind of interesting. We've seen tons of tutorials coming out lately, lots of examples, lots of ways to get involved. And obviously, you know, if you start working on this, we want you to be actively involved, not just building stuff with it, but giving us feedback, talking about the problems that you're having. This is a very active, living project, and we're trying to continue to make it better. And so, you know, all the libraries and everything, there's links to all of this here. So that's the important URL. But createjs.com, we have an active community, community.createjs.com, a Google list, and of course, the most important place is the GitHub where you can get the code. So that pretty much wraps me up. I am supposed to show you this. Make sure you read all of this. That's the session evaluation URL, and that's something. I think I have like 10 minutes left, so I'm happy to answer any questions that you guys have. Oh, actually, let me show you one quick thing before I, sorry, I like, I'm a tease, that's just how I work. So while I don't recommend this, I do think it's an interesting experiment. I set out to see whether or not you could build a whole game inside of Flash Pro and export it using Publish, or using Toolkit. And the answer to it is yes, you actually can. You can, you know, stick all of your JavaScript into the timeline just like you would do way back in the day developing Flash content. And so, you know, nothing on my sleeves. There's just an FLA in that directory. And I can publish this out and get a working game. Right? So it is possible to actually do all your logic in the timeline as well, which probably not normally the best way to do it, but for things like banner ads, you know, you can get your creative team just kicking out simple content using nothing but Flash Pro. So, sorry, question.
200 to know regarding the regards to a lot of the canvas, I think with the platform or some of these tools, is there anything that's going into research and development for accessibility? Here in Canada, we've got new guidelines that are coming down from the Ontario government, Canadian government, for any documents and tools and web platforms need to be accessible.
So that's a great question. So the question is, what about accessibility, basically? Canvas, not accessible. It's pixels, right? This is part of the reason that we have things like DOM element, for example, is so that you can keep textual content out of the canvas, because it's not the right place for it, right? And Canvas does a bad job of rendering text. Obviously, a lot of this content is stuff that really doesn't benefit that much from accessibility anyway. Like, a lot of these games are not going to be playable through a screen reader. Banner ads, etc. So the answer is no. There is nothing specifically for accessibility. I do think that there's definitely a realm there for figuring out what the best practices are around accessibility, how to take content that if you have a rich version, you can have those divs live and be perfectly happy in a screen reader, but then get, you know, messed around inside of a richer experience when it's available. Yes?
So you said one of your pet peeves was compared to Flash was the file size. One of my pet peeves is working with originally ActionScript 3,
mm-hmm.
now going, I almost call it downgrading to JavaScript.
Yep.
Is there, do you use anything else? Like, for example, are you looking at, say, for example, CoffeeScript or TypeScript and using it in the future to?
So this is definitely, yeah, it is one of my pet peeves. I mean, going from ActionScript 3, which is like a nice typed language, you know, quite strict, but optionally strict, down to JavaScript, which can't even do inheritance properly yet, is painful. We have taken the approach of teaching ourselves to be the best JavaScript developers that we can. We actually do have, I think they're called externals or definition files for TypeScript. So TypeScript is like Microsoft's approach to, you know, for example, CoffeeScript. I've had a lot of people ask for CoffeeScript versions, but I don't like the idea that when I go and do it in CoffeeScript, it's going to wind up with a intermediate compiler step. I'm not going to have a lot of control of what comes out of it. Some control, but not a lot. And that if you're trying to integrate not using CoffeeScript, then suddenly you're getting like a second-class citizen library, right? So we've stuck pure JavaScript. But like, I really like the TypeScript approach. I haven't gotten too deep into it yet, but I like the fact that I can take a library that's pure JavaScript, that's written to be really friendly as pure JavaScript, create some definitions that define all the typing and all the relationships, and then bring that into a TypeScript compiler, or TypeScript IDE, like, you know, WebStorm is adding support, obviously Visual Studio, and get a lot of those benefits, but still have the parts I want to be public be pure JavaScript, right? Like, I might write a game in TypeScript if it's something that only we're going to work on. But open source, I like to stay pure JavaScript. Yes?
I think what you've done is awesome.
That's a great question. Thank you. Yeah.
This sort of really mimics what I can do, getting the artist to create the stuff they use best, and then I created my programming environment. So I'm sort of curious about why, when you created the flash thing that took out the octopus moving, could you have just left the octopus sitting there, since it was just essentially grabbing the asset?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually, if you look at the octopus one, for example, the developer output or the designer output, the octopus isn't moving. This is just its timeline animation that's running. When it started floating across the screen, that was the game I had built around it.
So each movie clip sprite becomes an object within the sort of JavaScript.
Yeah, totally. And you know, one of the nice things about this too is, as a developer, I'm usually going to ignore the like stage object, right? Because we create an instantiable object that represents the stage itself or the root itself, and as a developer, I'm probably going to ignore that. I'm probably going to create my own route, and I'm going to bring in the assets that I need. And that leaves the designer free to like play around with animating stuff around on this stage, and it's not going to affect me. I can just grab that octopus and do what I want with it instead of, it's kind of suggestive, but instead of like having to worry about how they animated it across the screen. Any other questions?
You're good on
25. Cool. So maybe one more question if anyone has one. Cool. Thanks for adding that. And thank you again, guys.